It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the United States spends billions every year on infrastructure projects in other countries. We'll find out about a bill awaiting a Senate vote that would double the current spending cap. First, reactions have been mixed to Governor Walker's call for state senators to help keep a Kimberly-Clark plant from closing in the Fox Valley. In a letter to senators on Friday, Walker urged them to visit the Cold Spring facility in Fox Crossing. He also wants them to vote on a $100 million incentive package by the end of the month, a deadline set by Kimberly-Clark. Over the weekend on Upfront with Mike Gushee, Senate President Roger Roth of Appleton, a Republican, echoed those comments.
This just isn't about the jobs at Kimberly-Clark and Casey today. This is about the investment. Kimberly-Clark is looking to do a potential $500 million of investment at this facility over the next 15 years. So we are setting the stage to have Kimberly-Clark, an anchor industry, an anchor company within an anchor industry here in our state, have a presence here for generations to come. That's why it's so important that we come together and pass this.
But finding the votes may be a challenge, as only one other senator has come out in full support of the plan. At least two Republican senators have said they'd vote against it, meaning it would take Democratic votes to pass the plan. Patrick Marley is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, tell us more about the letter for the governor trying to get the Senate back into session for this.
So that's exactly what's happening. The governor is trying to meet the September 30th deadline. It's fast approaching, and it's clear they're very short of votes to try to make that happen. He's asked senators to go tour the facility. He's hoping that that will get more of them on board with his plan for these incentives that will cost tens of millions of dollars in the coming years.
And talk about that September 30th deadline. Where did it come from, and do we know if it's a firm deadline or maybe there's wiggle room?
Well, it's a deadline imposed by Kimberly-Clark, so they're the ones who run the factory or the plant and will decide whether to keep it open or not. You know, they announced back in January they were going to be closing 10 facilities worldwide, and this is one of them that was targeted. I think Republicans, certainly Senator Fitzgerald, the majority leader, has said recently, just before that deadline was announced publicly, that he thought that they had a couple of years to get this, that the facility in any case would be running for a while and there might be a way to save it yet. But right after that, Kimberly-Clark said they need to make their decision and they want to know one way or the other by September 30th. They're also in talks with Arkansas for a plant there, and you know, as if things go well for one state, they're probably going to go bad for the other one. So there's a little bit of a bidding war here.
And Kimberly-Clark is actually planning on closing two plants in the Fox Valley, as I understand it. But the state is focused, the governor and state lawmakers are focused on just one of those?
That's right. So there's two in the Neenah area, Neenah and Fox Crossing. One employs about 500, one employs about 100. Both are scheduled to be closed. Initially, when the Assembly passed this package back in February, they were saying they could save both facilities, and that's how this package was targeted. But more recently, Republicans have given up on the idea of saving the smaller plant with 100 employees, saying that their best hope is only to save the one that employs about 500 people.
You mentioned a deal that had passed the Assembly. That's what the Senate would be voting on. Big picture, what would this incentive package do?
So this is structured on the deal that was given to Foxconn last year on a per-job basis. So because it's a smaller facility and has fewer employees, it's not as big of a cash payment, but the per-job payments are the same. We've seen the fiscal estimate we've seen was premised on the idea of saving both plants, and that would be about $100 million, a little bit over that, over 2 years. It's going to be somewhat smaller than that now because under the latest plan, they would close one of the facility and save 500 jobs rather than 600. But, you know, safe to say it will be many tens of millions of dollars over about 15 years. Essentially, the state would cover 17% of the pay for workers at those facilities.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a proposed incentive package to try to keep Kimberly-Clark jobs in Wisconsin. The Assembly has passed it. The Senate hasn't. The governor wants the Senate to come back and do it. And Patrick, on the procedural side of things, as you mentioned, the Assembly passed a package earlier this year. The Senate, if they were to come back, which is an open question, would have to pass to the letter the same thing for it to go to the governor, right? Otherwise, the Assembly would have to come back to tackle any changes.
That's right. If the Senate comes back, which, like you say, is a big if they pass the identical package that the Assembly passed, then it goes straight to Walker and he can sign it. If they were to make any changes to it, then it would die unless the Assembly came back and agreed to that, or they had some kind of negotiation between the two houses. If it's a long shot for the Senate to come back, it's a much bigger long shot for the Assembly to come back. They feel like their work is done on this matter. So I think it's pretty much a take-it-or-leave-it piece of legislation at this point.
And some key Republicans want to leave it. Can you talk about opposition from especially conservative Republican senators?
Yeah, I mean, we really have, you know, Republicans are talking a lot about the need for Democratic votes, and it's clear that they would need Democratic votes to get it through. But right now they need a lot of Republican votes, too. Publicly, there are only two senators who are on board with this. They need 17 votes in all, so they're a long way from getting those. There's just as many Republicans who are publicly against it as there are for it at this point. Those Republicans say a Foxconn-type package was for a business that's transformational and supposed to be fundamentally changing the kind of work we do in Wisconsin, whereas a paper based plant is, you know, something that's been around for a very long time, not a cutting edge industry in the way that Foxconn is. So they just say, you know, ideologically they can't support a deal that is this rich.
Now, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss made a comment, I think it was in your piece, saying, hey, pass the thing and the governor can fix the details with partial vetoes. Does the governor have any interest in doing that from what you've seen?
So the governor says no. Robin Voss said that about a month ago, that because that the plan would differ somewhat from what the Assembly passed, but that the governor could make those changes with a partial veto, which made all the Democrats even more wary of this plan, saying they want to know exactly what the deal is. The governor more recently has said he is not going to issue any partial vetoes. He would sign the bill as is if it gets through the Senate.
What have we heard from local officials in the Fox Valley area where the economic impact of the plant's closing would be felt?
Well, they very much want to see it get done. They want to keep this plant open. These are, you know, workers in their communities. The local economy is the one that's going to be most affected by this. They're very concerned about all of the politics surrounding this. Obviously, we're heading right into an election with the governor's on the ballot, and Roger Roth, the Senate president, is from that area. He's up for election this year. So the locals are concerned that it's even harder to get a deal done at a time like this when you're in the thick of the political season.
And we have the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, WEDIC, as it's often called for short. Their job is to promote jobs in Wisconsin. Do they have anything in their toolkit that could make a difference in the absence of something passing the legislature?
Well, they do have the ability to offer incentive packages to companies like Kimberly-Clark, but they would not be as lucrative as the one that's pending in the legislature. So that would be a fallback option. But, you know, Kimberly-Clark only recently publicly said that it was interested in this deal for $100 million or thereabouts. I don't know how much the WEDC proposal would be if it did it on its own, but it would be far less than that. So I think there are real questions about whether Kimberly-Clark would be interested in something if the legislature can't pass it.
Now, the governor wants the Senate to come back in a session. Who's the decider? Who says, yeah, okay, we'll do it?
It is the Senate themselves. Republicans control the Senate 18 to 15. They're the ones who decide whether they come in or not. They're not going to do that unless they've got the votes locked up. And as I mentioned, it doesn't look like they've got those votes.
Have Democrats done much speaking out on this issue one way or the other? Democrats in the Senate, I should say.
So Democrats in the Senate and Tony Evers, who's running for governor, have emphasized they like different plans that would help others in the paper and forest products industry. And so they say they want a broader plan rather than focused in on this one plant. So that, without quite coming right out and say it, it appears that they all or virtually all are a no on this. So it looks like Republicans are going to have trouble.
And Patrick, as we wrap up, are you still there, Patrick? Okay, we'll wrap up there then. Thanks to Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've been talking about the governor's call for state senators to come back into session and pass a Kimberly-Clark incentive deal. As of right now, the Senate is not back in session, maybe not going to happen by this September 30th deadline indicated by the Kimberly-Clark Company. Now, the United States spends billions of dollars each year financing things like highways, bridges, and seaports in foreign countries, and a bill awaiting a vote by the Senate would allow us to spend a lot more. Although the Trump administration once wanted to eliminate the agency that handles the program, an increase in foreign investment by China has changed attitudes in Washington. Now, lawmakers from both parties are supporting more spending as a way to stay competitive around the globe. Josh Zumbrun is a national economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we have this bipartisan bill on international development. What exactly would this do?
This is a really interesting piece of legislation. You know, this is a part of the government that not a lot of people are thinking about very often. The government has an agency called OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. And what it does is it invests in projects all around the world in developing countries. And so it's similar to foreign aid in the sense that it's meant to help lower-income countries develop. But it's also quite different because these have to be commercial projects. All the kind of lending and financing that OPIC does, it does at a profit. The agency has been profitable for over 40 years. And so it's all loans and insurance premiums, and so it makes a lot of revenue on average. You know, obviously some projects have probably not worked out over that 40-year period. And what they're doing is they're going to more than double the size of this agency. They're going to fold a couple of other pretty obscure agencies into it and make it into a new, really robust agency that will be doing a lot of financing in the developing world.
And now, to the extent people did talk about this, you write that last year some Republicans, some people in the Trump administration wanted to scale it back or get rid of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so surprising about Congress being so close to making this agency so much more powerful is that just a year and a half ago, in President Trump's very first budget in February or March of 2017, the White House had proposed eliminating this agency entirely. They had proposed, you know, getting rid of all its funding and closing this agency down. You know, because there had been a view for a long time that, well, you know, why does the government need to be doing this sort of thing? Can't the private market take care of it? So it hasn't always been an agency that was very popular with conservatives, which is part of the reason why it's so surprising to see the really broad support in Congress for this piece of legislation.
And it seems like there's a one-word answer to that question you raise, and based on your reporting, that word is China.
The word is China. I mean, one of the things that attention of Congress has really been focused on is how much China is lending and financing projects all around the world. China has this thing called the Belt and Road Initiative. It's one of the most interesting government programs that a foreign country has ever operated, I think, in some ways, because of the scale of it. China's thought to be willing to lend, you know, over $1 trillion. Nobody knows exactly how big this thing is, how big they're willing to make it, but they're lending into the trillions of dollars to fund infrastructure projects all over the world. But the infrastructure projects have a twist. Almost all of them make it easier for the country getting that infrastructure project. You know, these are ports and airports and superhighways and rail lines, and almost all of them link those countries economically to China. You know, there are rail lines that run toward China, there are superhighways that run toward China, there are ports that, you know, allow that maritime access to China. And so, you know, what's happened is this project, Belt and Road, has gotten bigger and bigger. There's been a big awakening in the Senate, at the House of Representatives, and the administration of the desire to do something to counter China's huge activities in this area.
And the way these Chinese loans work in some cases is if the company can do the project, make money on it, and pay China back, great. If they can't, well, hey, there's some collateral. China ends up coming out pretty good anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting case where this happened in Sri Lanka, the, you know, island nation off the coast of India, where China had helped provide financing for this huge port, a huge seaport. And Sri Lanka had no ability to kind of pay the loan back for this. And so what they ended up doing to get out of the debt was they gave China a 99-year lease on this port. And so now China controls this lease. They control this port. This, you know, this is an interesting and important location on the Indian Ocean that gives China kind of access to trade routes with Africa and Asia and the Middle East. And now China has control of it for the next century because Sri Lanka couldn't pay back that loan. And so that's kind of the biggest example of why people are, one of the reasons that people in the U.S. have become really worried about what China is doing and why there was this desire in the Senate and the administration, a bipartisan desire, to do something meaningful to counteract it.
Talking to Josh Zumbrunn from the Wall Street Journal about the new revival of interest in a U.S. program that does commercial lending, among other things, for development projects around the world. Josh, is there a sense that, hey, if we don't build it, the Chinese, will come? If we are absent from this scene, China will fill the vacuum?
That's absolutely right, and that's something that we've heard, that I've heard from foreign officials that I've talked to, and it's something that people in the White House say they've heard a lot from foreign officials, is that, you know, these people say, look, we'd rather be doing business with the United States than China. We'd rather be doing business with the U.S. private sector than the Chinese government. One of the interesting things about this agency is that it's set up so that it always has a private partner. This agency, OPIC, never does a project directly with a foreign government. They always have some sort of private enterprise that's involved, and a lot of countries really want that. They want to be involved with the American private sector, but they just haven't always had the opportunity. The United States just hasn't always been there. Certainly not at the scale that China has been willing to be there in recent years. And so that's what's kind of caused this awakening: is that, you know, a lot of countries would like to be with the U.S. system, but China is the one there willing to write really big checks for the projects that are often popular in these countries. I mean, these countries often want better harbors and airports and highways and railroads. So these are projects that the countries typically want. They can't necessarily afford them, but they want them. And China is the one there offering the money to do it.
When OPIC, with a private partner, comes into a country, does one of these projects, does it have that same sort of all roads lead to U.S. Mentality that these Chinese programs do? Do they build roads, harbors, whatever, pointed at, metaphorically, the United States?
Well, the agency does have a purpose of kind of furthering U.S. kind of foreign policy and national security interests, but it's not as focused on trade routes as the Chinese initiative is. And you look at these the projects that the U.S. OPIC has gotten involved with, and they'll often be things that are a little bit different in nature. They can be, you see a lot of telecommunications projects. They've done a lot of things, you know, building cell phone towers all across Africa, for example, or they do a lot of power plants. You know, they've helped build power plants in Latin America and Southeast Asia, those kinds of projects that aren't, you know, those aren't necessarily focused on driving trade from these countries to the U.S., but they're beneficial they're the potential to create win-win situations. I mean, that's the way that the people in OPIC think about what they do, is they look for projects that are good for business, that are good for the country, that'll be good for the relationship between the U.S. and its foreign partners. And so those are the kinds of projects that they do. They're not as exclusively focused as China is on building trade links to, you know, the U.S. Part of that's because trade links to the U.S. in general are already pretty good. I mean, you know, you can easily drive across the U.S. borders with other countries. China has a lot more land borders than we do. They've got a lot more of a, you know, they've got a much bigger continent to connect to than the U.S. Maritime ports into the U.S. they're not bad. A lot of ports are already oriented that way. So the projects are a little bit different from what the kind of projects the U.S. wants to do are a little bit different, but they're still, you know, of a lot of interest to the countries.
Now, bringing this back to Congress, as you say, there's a lot of support, bipartisan support here, but there are some hurdles. This thing isn't done yet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it has passed the House unanimously, which is pretty remarkable.
Doesn't
in this
happen
day
often,
and age.
Yeah.
It happens often on smaller things that don't get much news attention, but it doesn't happen on something that's quite as substantive as this very often. And it's got a huge amount of support in the Senate. I mean, one of the things that we reported is that it's down to just a small handful of senators who are maybe a little bit skeptical of it. And if they can, if the supporters of the bill can kind of get them to drop their objections, then this legislation could move through a unanimous consent process in the Senate, which is a process that allows this bill to advance very quickly. They wouldn't need to take time away from any of the other stuff they're doing on the Senate floor in order to pass this legislation. So, you know, it looks like this legislation actually has enough support in the House and Senate to pass easily. And the challenge is the calendar. You know, it's very hard to find time to do things in the Senate. And they're very close to being able to do this in a way that doesn't even waste any time on the Senate calendar. So it looks like this bill has a very good chance. But, you know, the caution is that things sometimes get this close in Washington and sit for months or years or never even make it.
We'll keep watching for that. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Josh Zumbrun is a national economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He was with us to look at a bill moving through Congress that would raise the cap for U.S. spending on infrastructure in foreign countries as part of international competition with China. When it comes to concerts, U2 is about as big as they get. They own the first, eighth, and 13th highest grossing tours of all time. And if it wasn't for their 1983 album, Under a Blood Red Sky, they may not be the live success they are today. That, along with a companion concert film, helped establish the band as a top-tier live act. Now, considering how much time, money, and effort goes into making albums sound just right, why do some live albums seem so much better? What makes a great live album? Stephen Thompson is an editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. He's also a native of Iola, Wisconsin. Stephen, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Rob.
Well, I will say from a personal standpoint, that album we were just listening to is one of my favorites of all time. And a lot of tracks like New Year's Day there killed the studio ones for me. I don't want to hear those anymore because I like the live ones so much better. Do you have any songs or albums like that?
Yeah, I mean, I typically am somebody where I like to, you know, if I go to a concert, I'm always like wanting to hear the new stuff. I often wind up shifting a little bit more towards studio recordings. So a performer has to be incredibly special live for me to gravitate to a live album. But there are examples across the history of rock and roll, particularly, where a live album does so much more than a studio recording does. I mean, one of the first ones that sprung to my mind is Cheap Trick, which can often, a band that can often sound kind of limp and bloodless in the studio, but has this kind of crazed energy on stage that makes its songs, I think, irresistible.
What is it that makes a live album work, Stephen? What has to come together, do you think, for it to be, to make you feel like you were there?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work being done by producers and engineers to capture. I mean, it is not easy to capture a great live recording and make that energy translate into a disc that you carry around with you. So I don't think we should lose sight of the feat of engineering that goes into making a great live album. But I also think, bands that have incredible chemistry when they play together, that's a very important thing. And I don't think you can discount the power of the perfect audience.
Yeah, how much do you want to hear the audience when you're listening to a live album? Because sometimes it's like, wow, these guys are pumped, it's fun. And sometimes it's like, okay, that's plenty of crowd noise, let's hear the music a little more.
Oh yeah, I have thoughts. I want to hear a lot of cheering. I want to hear, you kind of want to hear that the audience is engaged. I don't want to hear clapping along. Only in certain circumstances do I want to hear singing along. But I tend to be someone who looks askance at when crowds are clapping along. I don't like clapping along. But at the same time, like, I sometimes love it when you have this very quiet and tender moment, and then a song ends and there's kind of this eruption of enthusiasm from a crowd. That to me is very powerful, because that puts you in the room and kind of gives you a sense of what people are feeling as a song is being performed.
Now, your old cronies, Stephen, at the AV Club, you were there back in the 90s. I had
sure
a list
was.
Of 20 live versions of songs that they say are better than their studio counterparts, and it's a great list of live albums. Here was their number one.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Thank you. train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
So there's Johnny Cash singing about Folsom Prison at, you know, prison.
Yeah.
This is not everybody's going to be able to create this unique moment, but this is a special one.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this recording. The original Folsom Prison Blues is from 1955, and, you know, it's a studio recording. It sounds like a studio recording. This recording that we just heard is from Johnny Cash's kind of 1968, I believe, comeback tour, when he was kind of revitalizing himself, kind of cleaning up his life and really trying to do something a little bit different. And so he goes and takes his band and goes to actual Folsom Prison and performs for the prisoners who are there, who feel that song in a way that no other audience can. And so you feel, there's so much going on in that performance. Everything from "Hello, I'm Johnny Cash," you know,
right?
You're just immediately transported to the place, and you feel his energy performing it. You feel the crowd's energy experiencing it. You are taken to a time and place in a really powerful way. I agree that was to me what popped into my head as like the best example of what we're talking about.
Talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about the best live songs and albums of all time. You could share your favorite. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One song you pointed us toward, Stephen, is a live version. This is Jeff Buckley and his cover of Hallelujah. We've got two bits from this one. Let's listen to a little bit of the body of the song.
And she tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
All right, Stephen, this has got to be in the running for the most covered song of all time, if it's not there yet. Why do you like this performance, this live release of it?
So what jumps out to me about this performance, first of all, you can hear the air in the room. Jeff Buckley leaves a lot of breathing space in this song, and I think his studio version of the song is basically perfect. I love it to the ends of the earth. But this recording is kind of one of the live recordings of his that I go back to again and again, in part because there is that weird kind of hanging in the air. You can imagine dust particles kind of dancing in the beams of light that head to the stage. You can really feel that the stillness in that room. And then at the end of that song, there is this incredible moment where he's let a note hang in the air, and then the song is over, and one person in the crowd screams, and then the whole room absolutely erupts. And there's this just cathartic release of just intensity of enthusiasm for the artist and for the performance that gives me chills.
Let's go to the end of the song now. You'd given us a heads up that was your favorite bit. Here's a listen. So you're okay with that kind of crowd noise in a live track, Steve?
Yeah, exactly. And you hear at one point, you kind of hear someone cough. You know, you have that sense of like everyone kind of trying to hold it together and be as quiet as possible until the moment that they can just explode in appreciation.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Ann is with us in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Mary Ann, hi. Oop, Mary Ann, are you there? Oh, looks like we lost her. Let's try Paul in Marshfield. If not, we've got a problem with the phone lines. Paul, hi.
Hey, guys.
Yay. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Just a couple entries there. First of all, Rob, I loved U2 growing up, and I loved their live stuff. And I have to say that's one thing that's maybe lacking from their music now is maybe a lack of spontaneity. I go back to probably the best live album that I think I've heard was The Last Waltz by the band. And, you know, my kids are growing up in an age now where it's not so much the albums, but the YouTube presentations. And my favorite track off of that one, I mean, there are lots of great ones, but I love Van Morrison. I think he does Caravan, and I'm not sure if he's completely there, but it is an awesome, awesome performance. I also love Peter Gabriel's Secret Live records with Sinead O'Connor, and then Paula Cole also singing, I think, on the live versions.
Wow. Paul, thanks. Paul had a lot there. Any you want to jump in on, Stephen?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think both of those examples are terrific examples of what I was talking about in the beginning about the importance of great engineering. And I love YouTube. I'm on YouTube all the time. But a lot of the live recordings that wind up on YouTube, you know, might be recorded with somebody's phone. Mm-hmm. It's hard to really fully, and you know, unless you have a really well-engineered recording to capture everything that's going on in a live performance. And The Last Waltz and those Peter Gabriel recordings are amazingly engineered. And it is very hard to capture all of the music that's going on stage.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the best live versions of songs and albums. Stephen Thompson is with us, editor and reviewer for NPR Music. You can hear him on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite live performance of a song? Do you even prefer it to the album version? Do you have a favorite live album that you like to go back to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
I want you to want me.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on the best live versions of songs and albums. Here's one by Cheap Trick. Stephen Thompson, our guest, mentioned Cheap Trick earlier as a great live album. He's an editor and reviewer at NPR Music, panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your favorite live albums, performances, songs, you name it. Back to our callers now. Ray is on the line in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
I'm really glad you included Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah. You just brought a tear to my eye. I used to tour with a band called the Bodines, and we were on the East Coast in Philadelphia, and I heard a riot going on upstairs from our dressing room, and I thought to myself, well, what is this? And when I went upstairs, it was the Violent Femmes, who had taken over the stage. And then a year later, I toured and recorded with them on Viva Wisconsin. So I want to put in Gone Daddy Gone as the best live album and best live performance from the Violent Femmes because I'm playing bass on it.
Ray, even without the personal standpoint, Violent Femmes live recordings, pretty good. I mean, and honestly, though, that's a band where, Stephen, their studio recordings feel kind of live, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much energy there, and just so much mischief going on. You know, legendarily great live band. You know, and honestly, the Bodines not so bad either.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ray. I talked to one of the Femmes, and he said they couldn't get live shows. Nobody would give them gigs, so they would they'd play for lines waiting for concerts, and that's how they got discovered back in the day.
You know, a caller before was talking about the lack of spontaneity that sometimes affects performances, and I think that energy that goes into some of those performances when you're talking about a band like the Violent Femmes and some of these bands as they're coming up, there's or Cheap Trick in 1979, you know, at the live album that we played, there is something to be said for hunger, and maybe you lose a little bit of precision, but you have this enthusiasm and this drive that comes through, and the audience really feels that. An audience can tell when a band is there because they love what they're doing and they want to entertain. That's very infectious, and it creates this kind of this loop of enthusiasm that's hard to deny.
Back to our callers now. Deborah is with us in Milwaukee. Deborah, hello.
Hi, I'd like to say I was actually in Central Park and taped with my little cassette recorder Simon and Garfunkel live, but that's not on my top of my list. I sing at the Milwaukee Theater, and when he performed 1,000 Years for his encore, it was just amazing. It's my favorite song. And then Seeds of Love by Tears for Fears, when I'm on my bicycle and I'm not looking at it, sometimes I'm always surprised, that's a live version. So, and then I saw Talking Heads at the Convention Center Arena in Dallas in 1983, and that was great too. So those are the top of my list.
All right, Deborah's favorite live shows. And Talking Heads is a band that makes the list sometimes the best live albums. Stop Making Sense, which was a movie too. Here's a listen to Life During Wartime. This is one that AV Club put on their choices. And Steven, I think this is a version I hear on the radio maybe as much as the studio version.
Yeah, this one has the benefit of being part of a film by Jonathan Demme that is one of the greatest concert films of all time. And part of what that recording gives you is not only the sound and the energy. You know, this is Talking Heads at the height of their powers. You also, when you hear it, you can picture it in your head. Even though, if you haven't seen this movie since it came out in 1983, you can still see David Byrne in your mind's eye. And I think, the power of a great concert recording sometimes comes through in the power of a great concert video.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Glad you caught some great shows. We're talking about some of the best live albums and songs of all time. Stephen Thompson with us from NPR Music. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Partyville. Hi, David.
Hey, good afternoon. I wanted to mention, if you haven't already done so, Frampton Comes Alive.
Yeah.
I think the biggest selling live album of all time. It's really awesome, from back in 1976. Peter Frampton, Do You Feel Like We Do, and a lot of other songs on that one. And then besides that, too, a little more contemporary is Samantha Fish. She's a contemporary blues artist, Americana. She does it all. And I don't think she has a live album out, but I've seen her live in Wisconsin here this year and a couple of times last year, and she's just an awesome guitarist and singer and songwriter, and you can probably catch some of her YouTube videos and also some things on her website, SamanthaFish.com.
David, thanks a lot for the call. So yeah, the Frampton Comes Live album, that's one, Stephen, I'll say when I've been driving at night, looking for something on the radio, you hit the beginning of Do You Feel Like We Do, you're like, okay, I'm set for like 10, 11 minutes now. It's almost like catching, the studio Inagata De Vita, the full-length album.
Well, and one of the great things about Frampton Comes Alive is because it is one of the best-selling albums of all time, not just best-selling live albums, it's part of the monoculture, right? And so you feel... Do you feel like it? You feel like you've heard that record. You almost feel like you've been to that show, because that record is just so much. It's like it's on the wind. And I think that's really nice. Whatever you feel about Peter Frampton, however those songs have aged for you, it is nice to have a live recording that like tens of millions of people have lived their lives to. You can just picture so much going on while people listen to that album in the 70s and 80s.
Let's go to another caller. Thanks, David. Kyle is with us now in Sheboygan. Kyle, hi.
Hello. How's it going today, gentlemen? I just wanted to mention an album that is closer to me. I'm 34 years old, so I haven't heard a lot of the older stuff when it came out, but Nirvana Unplugged.
Sure.
Unplugged album, if I think it. I can't hear
you so good, Kyle, but we got the Nirvana Unplugged, that MTV Unplugged edition, and this showed another side of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, Stephen.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because Nirvana kind of came out with this just burst of noise, and people reacted, it's grunge, and it influenced a lot of loud rock bands. But Kurt Cobain was at his heart a pop singer-songwriter. And so, he was able to recast a lot of his own songs and some covers in this quieter way that really showed you the impeccable craft at to core of these songs. That is a marvelous performance. And that whole MTV Unplugged series in general did a really great job kind of showing people musicianship where they might not have seen musicianship otherwise. I always go back to that LL Cool J performance on MTV Unplugged to get a sense of the power and the musicianship and the force behind hip-hop at a time when hip-hop was still becoming accepted by mainstream critics.
Rick, we've got a lot of clips that we're not going to get to because we've got so many great callers. Rick is next in Powers Lake. Rick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Rick?
I'm thinking, like I said, I'm thinking of Frank Zappa's Does Humor Belong in Music, and specifically Terry Bozzio's version of Whipping Post.
All right, Rick, yeah. Frank Zappa had an album live at the Roxy and elsewhere, and Frank Zappa's music's so complicated, it's hard to imagine people pulling it off live, yet there they were.
Yeah, part of it is you were getting this incredible technical feat, but you were also just getting this spirit of play that is so infectious.
All right, thanks, Rick. John in Whitefish Bay now. John, hi.
Hi. I'd say Deep Purple Made in Japan, because all the songs are improvised quite a bit, and they're quite a bit different than the studio. And just that whole era, like Frank Zappa, Roxy and Elsewhere, and Zeppelin, all those bands of that era were kind of improvising a lot on stage. You'd get a 7-minute song in the studio that was half an hour.
John, thanks. And that's an interesting point, Steve, because you get some stretching out with like the solos that you might not get on that, especially a radio-friendly album release.
Yeah, sometimes the live version is your favorite because it's different.
John, thanks. We're going through callers quickly here. Dennis in Eau Claire. Dennis, hi.
Hey, I think Bob Seger live, Turn the Page, is one of the best songs.
That's one that gets picked a lot, Dennis. And Live Bullet, I can't listen to Bob Seger's studio so much anymore. I grew up with Live Bullet because he was a Michigan guy, and that's where I was. And I still have a soft spot for that one, Stephen.
Yeah, it's another case of somebody who was so at home on a live stage and had a little bit of an uneasy relationship with the studio. Has some great studio recordings, but really kind of came through as a powerhouse live.
All right, a couple more. No time for calls. Mike in Appleton likes the Woodstock album. We heard from Chris on Facebook. Summertime Blues by The Who off their Live at Leeds album. Mm-hmm. People can keep commenting on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steven, does this make you want to go back and listen to something?
Oh my God. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm still sitting there seething with jealousy over the person who got to see Paul Simon at Central Park. My girlfriend is going to see his final concert this weekend, and I am bitterly, bitterly jealous.
Yeah, all right. Just use that jealousy to do great work for NPR Music. Steven, always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Rob. It's always a pleasure.
Stephen Thompson, we've been talking about great live albums. Keep it going. Ideas Network Facebook page. Here now is the creepiest story of the year that turned out not to be so creepy after all. As reported by the BBC, a woman in the English city of Ipswich kept being woken up at night by the distant sound of this. Yes, it's the creepy sound of a kid singing a nursery rhyme. She heard it on and off for months, and she was wondering if she was imagining things. She finally brought it to the attention of her local government to see if the creepy sound was actually happening and if they could figure out what it was. It was happening, and they could figure it out. After what I imagine as some Scooby-Doo-style detective work, they found out where the nursery rhyme was coming from. It was an alarm at a nearby factory. What? Turns out the factory had a problem with trespassers and vandals, so they put in a motion sensor camera that would play the nursery rhyme when somebody triggered it, and apparently that was creepy enough to drive trespassers away. But wait, why did it keep playing again and again? Was there a constant stream of vandals at night? No. On further inspection, it turns out a spider had set up its home on the camera. Every time it crawled across the camera, it triggered it, set off the alarm, and the creepy kid would sing again. Story has a happy ending. The factory turned down the volume a bit. The woman at the center of the story is sleeping soundly once again. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.